Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court, Robert Borges, registration number 19577, representing Toby Medina, the defendant appellant in this matter. And I'd like to focus on the first and second issues in the brief, and I'll rely on the briefing that we submitted regarding the third issue, unless the panel has any questions. But discussing the issues in order to save here, first being the speedy trial issue. As the court may be aware, the sequence of events in this case was that my client was charged with possession of contraband and conspiracy to commit or to possess contraband in 2007. He was arraigned on October 19, 2007, entered a plea of not guilty, and the court then attempted to set trial. Well, the court did set trial. Because Lincoln District Court was about to start a scheduled death penalty case in, I believe it was March of 2008, there was some problem with scheduling, and trial counsel for my client offered to make himself available in January, which would have been before the death penalty case. The court was looking at dates in April and was unable to come up with a date. So the deputy district attorney asked the court to toll the running of speedy trial for 60 days. When the court was unable to come up with a date in April, the court then gave a trial date in June of 2008. Trial counsel for the defendant did object to the setting and stated his reasons for the objection was the violation of speedy trial. There's case law, and I believe I cited two of the cases in my brief, that docket congestion is not a sufficient reason for violating the statutory speedy trial right. There's another case, Carr versus District Court at 190 Colorado, page 125. It's a 1975 case. It also says the same thing. I think I cited Gallagher and Pipkin in my brief. But if Lincoln County didn't have space available to try this case, I think it was incumbent upon the county to obtain the space. And I'm reminded of the situation here in Denver. Up until last year, Denver didn't have enough courtroom space in the city and county building, so they were leasing space in the Adams Mark Hotel on the fourth floor to hold county court cases. And, you know, Lincoln County could have done something else if they didn't have the facilities available. The other thing was staffing, and as things turned out in this case, the case was tried by a senior judge who was brought in from I think it was Eagle County. So lack of adequate personnel out in Lincoln County wouldn't have been a problem either, or wouldn't have been grounds to violate the statutory speedy trial right. The people argue that because the defendant only objected to the setting and didn't file a motion to dismiss, that he has not preserved this issue. It's our position that that argument elevates form over substance. The reason that that provision exists in the statute is so that the defendant alerts the trial court that there is a problem with setting beyond the 6 months, and the trial court then has time to correct the problem before the case is subject to being dismissed. It's our position that when Mr. Medina's trial counsel raised his objection and went into the reasons why, that was adequate to trigger the 6 month provision under the speedy trial statute.
Do you have any case that stands for that proposition?
I don't have any case that says precisely that. I do note, Your Honor, that the cases that the people cite in their brief, where the argument that a case was subject to dismissal was rejected because there was no motion made, one of those cases, I think it was People versus Munoz, 240 P3rd 311. There's language in there that focuses on the defendant's failure to complain about the detail, excuse me, about the delay in setting the trial date. That's on page 321 of the Munoz case. And I'll just read the one sentence, two sentences. Under section 18-1405, the defendant must move to dismiss before trial in order to receive relief from the trial court's failure to comply with the statutory speedy trial rule. Here, at no point before or during his trial did the defendant complain of delay or that he had been denied his right to a speedy trial, close quote. In our case, we would submit that by making his objection known when the case was set, that was sufficient. That was a complaint to the setting beyond the time limit.
Mr. Borges, I understand your position that it's elevating form over substance to say that an objection is not equal to a motion, but the statute doesn't say anything about making an objection. It says a motion is required. And aren't we required to apply the statute as written?
I understand where Your Honor is coming from. The statute does use that language, that the defendant must make a motion, but it's
otherwise it's waived.
Well, we would submit that the objection is sufficient.
Do you have any canon of statutory construction we could rely on if we were to go your way? Okay.
If there are no other questions on that issue, I was going to move on to the second issue, and then I wanted to reserve 5 minutes of my time. Well, I've got plenty of time. With the second issue, and I think my brief sets out the chronology of events in this case, the testimony that was offered at trial. But basically, this case revolved around the testimony of Lieutenant Debbie Outen and Sergeant John Bowker. Those were the two corrections officers, and Lieutenant Outen in particular testified that when the lockdown was called, my client went to his cell on the third tier. Joey Mestis, whose cell was on the first tier, did not go to his cell, but instead went upstairs. She observed a conversation take place between my client and Mr. Mestis through the door to my client's cell. And then she saw Mr. Mestis, I believe she said, he bent down, spoke to an individual, presumably my client, through the holes in the door and reached under the door to pick up a package. And that was on the December 3rd transcript, page 245. She couldn't testify as to what she saw pass. It could have been anything. In fact, she couldn't describe what she saw as far as passing between them. She then saw Mr. Mestis run downstairs or move downstairs, attempting to pass something off to other inmates who were not accepting whatever it was he was passing. Finally, he reportedly gave something to inmate Krause. There was a metal hitting metal sound from Krause's cell, and then a little while later, the two shanks were found in Krause's the toilet in Krause's cell. That's the basis of this case, and it's our position that this does not satisfy the substantial and significant evidence test that's necessary for purposes of evaluating sufficiency of the evidence.
Excuse me for interrupting. Did the film show, though, that something was passed between the cells?
The witness testified. The lieutenant testified that she saw something pass, but she couldn't describe what she saw. So,
that make a jury question?
It's our position, Your Honor. If it was a jury question, this is so thin that it isn't sufficient.
A question about your argument regarding the conspiracy charge, sufficiency evidence on the conspiracy charge. On page 24 of your opening brief, you say, where two inferences can reasonably be drawn from underlying facts, one consistent with guilt and the other one consistent with innocence, the inference consistent with innocence should be drawn. I have two questions about that sentence. First of all, you don't cite any authority in support of that proposition. So my question is, do you have any authority that supports that? Because in my mind, doesn't that run completely contrary to our basic black letter law that says on appeal, we look at all inferences in favor of the prosecution?
And to answer the first part of your question, Your Honor, I don't have any authority on that. And the people did point that out in their answer brief. I think for purposes of I think Your Honor brings up a valid point. Okay. If there's no other questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You've got about 5 minutes and 45 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Borges.
May it please the court. My name is Alice Hosley, registration number 32195, appearing on behalf of the people. It seems at this stage that we're at now, my opposing counsel has conceded that there was not a specific motion to dismiss as is required by the statute. So I think the issue has evolved to does either of the statements and objections to the speedy trial setting, the first one being on October 19th when the trial date was set for June 11th, and then also collaterally the last date on June 11th when he asked for a motion to continue trial, whether either one of those can be construed as a motion to dismiss as is required by 18.1.405.5. In the reply brief, it seems the crux of their argument is that the first objection at the time that speedy trial was set on October, or excuse me, the first time the trial was set on October 19, 2007, that alone was a functional equivalent of the motion to dismiss. My position is that fails for several reasons. One is that objection to the time of setting isn't a functional equivalent because the relief being sought is different. At the time that the trial is being set, a statutory speedy right has not been violated. There has not been a violation just by setting the trial outside of the six-month parameter. So the objection at that time is very different than seeking relief to have your case dismissed. You're asking for two very different remedies from the court at that time. So I don't think it can be considered the same or a functional equivalent. Secondly,
but Ms. Hosley, are you saying at that time on the date of the setting when the objection was made, the speedy trial deadline had not yet run?
Correct.
And it was just the setting, and so there had not yet been a speedy trial violation at that on that date?
That's correct. And the motion to dismiss, what we gained from the case law that has evaluated these type of arguments is that the motion to dismiss is actually not ripe until the point in time that the six-month statutory speedy trial has run. So the objection at the time that the trial was set cannot be considered a motion to dismiss for that reason as well.
And I take it that that's because you don't know what the future events are going to be. I suppose the judge could change his or her mind and reset it.
That's correct. A lot of things can happen in that time period, as happened here. And that's why the defendant did ultimately seek a motion to continue, albeit outside of the original speedy trial time frame. But please don't interpret my argument as trying to defend setting trial, the trial court not honoring the defendant's wishes to set within the 6 months. But I don't think that alone, the setting alone, does not violate the statutory speedy trial right. The dismissal is a sanction for the trial not commencing within that 6 months. So in order to get the benefit of that sanction, defendant is required to actually make an affirmative statement that can be ruled on, an affirmative motion. And if they don't do that, the trial court hasn't committed any error by not sua sponte dismissing based on the statutory speedy trial. I'd also like to respond to the arguments in the brief that it would have been futile to file a motion to dismiss because of the previous failure to set the trial within the 6 months after the objection. The court noted at the time that it set it that it was trying to accommodate the six-month time frame. And again, it's that idea that there are different reliefs being sought. I think it's speculative, and we don't have anything in the record that would allow us to assume that if a motion to dismiss had been made after the termination of the speedy trial right or the speedy trial timeframe, that motion would not have been granted, asking, posing the objection in October is not the same relief requested. And essentially, the defendant is seeking to eviscerate the language of the statute that requires this motion to dismiss. I understand that it doesn't feel right to reward the trial court or the prosecutor for setting this outside of the statutory time frame over the objection. I'm no way defending that, but the question before this court and where we are now is, were the proper channels done? Were the affirmative actions taken to actually dismiss the case? And I think the statutory language is very clear that absent a motion to dismiss, or even something that can be reasonably construed as a motion to dismiss, results in a waiver. I think the statutory language is clear, and I think it's there for good reason. It puts some of the onus on the defendant to actually make take affirmative steps to seek the benefit of the sanctions that are allowed in the statute. Finally, as to the prejudice resulting in the habitual counts that opposing counsel argues, the defendant was prejudiced by the delay in the speedy trial because the habitual counts weren't added. I would just point to the record, the very first day of the arraignment and the time the trial was set, the prosecutor informed the court and the defendant that it would be filing habitual counts. Habitual counts are allowed to be added at any time before the start of trial. So I think it's speculative to say that regardless of when trial was set, that those counts would not have been added properly as they were done in this case. So I think that prejudice argument does not carry the weight to overcome the statutory language, which requires a motion to dismiss.
So is there a time break between the jury finding and then the trial on the habitual criminal counts? Did it immediately follow the jury trial, or was there a time break of several months?
Yes, there was a time break. There was. Quickly on the sufficiency, I would direct the court to the opening brief. The opening brief challenges the trial court's decision on the judgment of acquittal, and it does not raise an independent sufficiency argument. I think that's important because the posture of this case at the time that the trial court ruled on the motion of judgment of acquittal was before the defense put on its case. And there was some testimony in the defense case about ownership of these shanks that there was no conspiracy, that the co-defendant in the case, Mr. Maestas, was the exclusive owner. So I would direct the court to the argument made here, which is specifically to the motion for judgment of acquittal. The trial court couldn't err in not considering evidence that hadn't been presented at the time that it ruled on the motion.
Assuming we were to view this as a regular motion for request to review the sufficiency, would that make a difference in the outcome?
No, I don't think it does. I just think it's important to consider when ruling on whether or not the judge erred. The opening brief makes it sound as if it erred because it didn't consider this evidence. It didn't give it the appropriate weight. So I simply want to point out
it hadn't come in yet.
They couldn't err. But no, I think certainly the defense case at trial gave some conflicting testimony, something to consider. But I think there was substantial and sufficient evidence even based on the facts given by opposing counsel here today, for there to be sufficient evidence to sustain the convictions. As Your Honors pointed out, the standard is the light most favorable to the prosecution, and circumstantial evidence carries its weight. It doesn't have to be direct evidence. There was five people testified as to the events that played out, all of it consistent with the conviction of the defendant that he not only possessed the contraband, he was in his cell by himself when a package slid out from underneath, and ultimately it was determined that there were two homemade shanks in that package. So I would just want to make sure that the court understands at what point the evidence had been presented, but also certainly my position is there was sufficient evidence to sustain both of these convictions. If there are no other questions, I thank the court for its consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Hosley. Mr. Borges, you've got some time for rebuttal if you want it.
Thank you. I'll just be very brief. First, addressing Judge Plank's question, the trial was in December of 2008. It was a two-day trial. It was over, I believe, on December 3rd. The habitual trial was about a year later. It was December 2009. Just a couple of things, Your Honor. Your Honors, in regard to Judge Terry's question about whether consideration of the testimony of Joey Mestis mattered, it depends on what standard of review this court applies. The people take the position that the standard of review and the sufficiency of the evidence is whether the trial court, I believe, abused its discretion in denying the motion for judgment of acquittal. It's our position, and I think I cited the authority in Dempsey is the case I cited in my opening brief. Then there's a number of other cases I cited in my reply brief, that this court is can give de novo review to a sufficiency of the evidence claim. And we're requesting that you do that. And if the court gives de novo review to the sufficiency of the evidence claim, everything is considered by this court in determining whether there was sufficient evidence. The case in chief, the defense case, and the rebuttal evidence. Finally, the people argued that the defendant didn't move to dismiss or make anything that I believe it was resembled a motion to dismiss. I just reiterate that it's our position. Clearly, he did not say I moved to dismiss, but he did object, and he did do it in a timely manner in that it allowed the trial court ample opportunity to cure the problem that was coming. It's somewhat anomalous that the defendant could have kept his mouth shut at the time of setting, waited the 6 months, and on day 6 months plus 1 day, then moved to dismiss, at which point the court couldn't have done much to remedy the situation. Instead, he objected early on when the problem could have been fixed. And that's the kind of behavior should probably be encouraged, as opposed to ambushing the court by waiting the 6 months and then moving to dismiss. If there are no other questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. An opinion will issue in due course.